Session number 17623, Henry Watson, Reel 9.
Mr. Watson, Reel 9. You tell me that of your capture and being handed over to, by the Germans to the Italians. What happened then?
Well, we were all in a big circle and we were getting our heads down for the night. We'd been marching during all the day and the Germans were doing a bit of shelling and we were on the receiving end. There was a good crowd of us. I don't know how many there were there. But they'd caught up with some South African coloured fellas in the meantime, and we had this big circle of soldiers lying on the sand, getting their heads down, when a column came through us, what a British column, or an Allied column, I should say, broke right through the middle of where we were, and it came in the bottom end where the coloured lads were, broke through there, and it was the 7th Indian Div. They were breaking out of Mercer Matru, and they came right through, and I didn't know, but there was some of my civilian pals on it, so they could have given us a lift, but they didn't. Well, I nearly got a lift, but I nearly got the other and all. Everybody ran. And I said before that Jimmy
Madison,
he was one of the prisoners. Well, everybody scarpered, me and all. And they all kept going. And after I'd run a good bit, I looked back. And there was a truck standing, a 3-tonner truck. So I thought, well, if there's nobody in that truck, I might as well be having a ride as walking. So me and my pal went back to the truck, and there was a coloured driver in it, but he'd been shot. So I pulled him out, and I got into the truck. The engine was still running. I got into the truck. And I was just about ready to pull away, and I got such a thump in the ribs. And I looked around. Here's a little Italian had been hiding under it, but he had the rifle and the bayonet on. And that was in my ribs. No way could I get out of that. You know, it flashed through my mind a dozen different ways. If I tried this, if I tried that, nah, that click of the finger was faster than I could move. So that was me back in the bag. And I was annoyed because about 2 days later when they emptied the truck, we found it was the naffy truck. There was enough water and grub in it to have lasted me for 6 months down in the deep south.
So you're back with the Italians then, were you?
Yeah, I was back with the Italians.
Did you worry in those initial moments, to go back to those initial moments, did you worry about home? Did your mind flash back to home?
Oh, yes, you just thought it would, you know, I wonder how long it'll be before they get to know I'm a prisoner. Well, it was a hell of a long time. And the thought that I've still got the papers to say we regret that he's missing and presumed killed or something. And it'd be a bit horrendous to get in the post that. So that was it. Then it took us to Mercer Matru. That's where we went to next. We were on the beach at Mercer. I met one local lad there. And from there, we were put in trucks, German trucks, and driven farther east. forget the name of the place now, put into a prison camp there. Later on, went by boat. I went to a prison camp just outside the brook. And then they took us down to the brook harbour and put us in some little colliers. And they sneaked away up the coast and put us in, back in farther up there. Benghazi. And we marched out onto a hilltop where there was a prisoner of war camp that was guarded by Italians, and it was not very pleasant at all.
What was unpleasant about it?
Well, there was very little to eat, very little to drink, no cover at all, just some drum sheets, and the whole damn place was lousy. Within minutes, I think everybody was covered with lice.
Were you just lying on the ground, were you?
Yeah, yes, yeah.
How were they feeding you prior to this, since being captured up to this point? Were they feeding you okay?
I can't think of getting fed at all, actually. I know that was the place where they gave us some tinned meat, and some of the brighter boys reckoned it was horse. But it didn't matter, it was all right to eat.
How did the Italian guards treat you? Because you'd moved from frontline troops who took you to... You know.
Well, I think the threat is pretty rough, because I think they were more frightened than anything else. They were scared that we might start something.
There'd be a lot more of you than there were of them.
Oh, yes, yes. Only they had a lot more rifles than we had.
How long were you in this particular camp?
I couldn't tell you. Not that long. Not that long. And they took us down to the harbour and took us on a boat and took us over to Italy. And that's when we're proper prisoner of war experience started in Italy.
That must have been a bit of a worrying journey, because boats have been sunk on the way over.
Yeah, yes, yes.
Well, did they fasten you down in the hold of the boat? Or?
Oh, we're in the hold. They let so many out at a time to use the toilet facilities, which was over the wall, over the rail in the ship. I had a photograph taken, if I mentioned it earlier, up in Mosul. There's a chap called McKenna, and I had my photos taken. There was a group of the MT lads, but there's none of them wanted the photographs because they were too dear. Well, I bought one, and Larry McKenna bought one. Well, I went into PG-70, prisoner of war camp, and there's a lad came into the camp later on. He said, "I have a photograph of you, Sergeant." I said, "You can't have a photograph of me. I don't know you." He says, "I have." He says, "There's you and another corporal." He says, "And it's all covered with blood." I says, "Well, were you on?" I mentioned the boat that we went across to Italy in. No, they were in another one. He was in another one that had been torpedoed. And this photograph, that with all the blood on it, was on the deck. And he just picked it up. He saw DLI and Ordnance Corps badge. He just picked it up and stuck it in his pocket. And after the walk, I contacted Larry McKenna. He lived at Concord. And I gave him it back.
So he had survived. It wasn't, was it his blood?
It was his. Yeah. Aye.
Being wounded.
Yes. And I'm saying it was his. We assume it was his. It's an assumption rather than a fact.
When you arrived in Italy, do you recall where you arrived, which port?
I think it was Brindisi we went into. We'll march through the streets.
How did the Italian population who were watching you obviously march through the streets?
Well, they weren't very pleased. I think they'd been roughly the first prisoners they'd seen going in, and they weren't very much amused with us. A lot of catcalls and what have you. But that didn't worry us. We put us on a train, I think. We went to Bari, I think it was.
Was this the cattle truck type
yes,
train?
Yes, yes, yes. Went to Bari, and then from Bari, we went up to Porto San Giorgio, near Fermo. And we got off the boat there and put onto a little narrow gauge railway truck or set of trucks, and we went up the hill to Fermo and down the other side into quite a large building space, wired off all round, a lot of huts in it, and apparently it was a factory that was in the process of being built, and we got stuck in there, and that was the start of the page 70 episode.
What condition were you in by this time?
Oh, it wasn't too bad a condition, a bit thin. We hadn't been getting much to eat, and there was a lot of dysentery amongst the fellas.
And had that been a problem on the train coming up?
That had been a problem on the boat coming over as well.
PG 70, can't you say it was a hutted camp?
Not a hut as such. There were big buildings, high buildings. It was a factory to be. And there were... Well, it was a factory in the process of being built. In fact, there were loads of Italian workmen still in it. The huts were big huts, big buildings, and the one that we used for a theatre, of all things, I think it held about, almost a few hundred. And there were fellas sleeping in there, but we soon lost that as well, theatre, because there were more people coming in. So we're all sorted out into groups of 50, and a group commander in charge of each group, just a senior rank, in charge of each group of 50. There was loads of sergeants there. Well, they went into a group of their own. There were some officers there. They hadn't got them sorted out as to what they were going to do with them. The toilets at the time was just a huge pit dug in the middle of the compound and a couple of planks across. And you never had to get on the back plank.
Washing facilities, what were they like?
They were building, they had built them, but they hadn't got them finished. But they'd got the water turned on, were able to get just washed in just troughs of water.
Cold water.
Cold water, oh yes.
Cooking, and how did you get on for food and cooking?
The cooking had... they had a cookhouse there. Big... receptacles for cooking the stuff in. There was no sundae's joints or anything like that. It was rice and macaroni. Rice on the Monday, macaroni the Tuesday. Rice on the Wednesday, macaroni the Thursday. There, with the rice, we used to get a little bit of grebe in sometimes, and that was a mangel wurzel leaves that they used to bring in from the farm, or that from Fermo, the place at the top of the hill, from the market. And that did no good either. Those greens, they helped everyone on their way to the toilet.
How many meals a day did you get?
One meal, as such. And in the morning, I think we used to get a cup of coffee in the morning. Coffee, they called it. It was ersatz stuff made with... chestnuts, I think, or something. We used to grind them up and... Never mind, it was ersatz stuff. No milk, no sugar or anything like that, just the coffee. That was in the morning. Dinner time... 12 o'clock, that's when you used to get your skilly. And
skilly was your rice or your mangels?
That's right, yes.
Was that a prisoner's name for the food?
Yes.
Skilly,
sorry. The midday meal. And at night, at tea time, 4 o'clockish, you got 200 grams of bread. And a little loaf of bread that's about that size.
And the size of a bun.
Yeah. And a small piece of cheese. And that was your lot for the day. And a cup of coffee. I don't know what it was. I thought it wouldn't be tea. Like it was just dished out dry, I think.
Were you sleeping on beds or bunks?
We're on bunks, and when we first went in, we had white sheets. And then coarse, very coarse linen, and we hadn't had them very long, and they were all recalled, and that was the end of them. They said they were going to send them away to get washed, so they must have lost them all.
How many people were there in a hut, or in a sleeping quarters? Sleeping and living quarters, were they?
A couple of hundred plus in each one.
And these were divided into groups of about 50 under the command of a senior.
That's right.
Were you in the sergeant's group?
No, I was one of the group commanders.
And who had you with you in your group, do you recall?
The second man was Andy Davidson, Sergeant Davidson. He was the intelligence sergeant in the 9th. He's now living, if he's still alive, he's now living in London. He lived in Gateshead then. There was one or two Durhams, actually, in the group. There was a cross-section, there was some Ordnance Corps fellas in, there was all sorts.
And what were your responsibilities as leader of the group?
Just looking after that lot. Make sure you get the groom for them. And when they came, any meal for them. You know, anything for that group or anybody that was in that group, it was my responsibility to see that they got it.
And were you spokesman for the group if you had any queries of any kind?
So if they want, if any queries, they go and sort themselves out. Because if you started to be spokesman, Father God, you'd never be done. There was more cribs than enough. I mean, it was a Spartan existence then. It really was. But you just had to take it as it was, make the best of it. All the criminalness didn't do him the good.
What time, what date, time would this be?
I think it would be sometime in the autumn, in the back end, October. I couldn't be sure. I have a book somewhere with the date that I went into the camp, but I've been hunting for it. I can't find it.
And you see, the Spartan conditions, you're coming into the autumn time of the year,
yes,
aren't you? So
yes.
Things were cooling down. And
mm-hmm.
What condition were you? Were you captured in the khaki uniform or
yes.
your KD?
KD. And various amounts of KD. I mean, some had the shorts and the shirts, what have you. And there was one chap that I knew very well, he had no boots. And he ran around all the time in Italy with no boots on. In fact, he was a pal of mine.
So some people would have thin clothing.
Oh, all had thin clothing.
We all had thin clothing.
Yes, but some had more thin clothing than others.
How were you beginning to cope with the cooling down of the weather?
Oh, we weren't taking it too well because it was cool.
And was there any heating in the establishment?
No. None at all.
So it was October. When did mail start to come? Obviously, you say it took quite a while for your parents to get to know where you were anyway. How did they get to know?
Red Cross.
Did they appear early, the Red Cross people?
Where?
At the camp.
Never saw any.
So it was the Italians that must have let the Red Cross
know. I think we sent a card in to the Red Cross, stamped the number, rank and name, and that you were a guest of the forces and having a hell of a time and a whale of a time, you know.
Italian guards again. They would be poor quality troops, presumably,
yes.
If you could call them that.
Yes.
Were they still treating you rather badly?
No, they were just in the little bunk, little hut. What do you call it? Around the camp.
The towers.
Towers around the either. Just showed a bit of, little bit, and sing all night because they were frightened of the dark, frightened to go out amongst them, I think. But one of the things that, you see, if you could keep yourself occupied, well, I did. The lad that had no shoes on, no boots, called him Simmons, Henry Simmons. I think his name was Bob Simmons, but he always got Henry Simmons in the army. Well, Simmo and I were good friends, and Simmo was brilliant on radio work. That was his trade. And in the camp, we would organise, or different people organised, different classes. You could more or less get a class in anything. Well, Simo started a class on radio. Well, I didn't know the aerial hole from the earth hole when that started. But something to do, I went to the classes. And he taught us from memory a hell of a lot about radio. We could design a radio set, the theory of it, but no practical. Now then, we got paid so many lira per week by the Italians. That was an arrangement they had with the British government. Well, we used to get this money. Well, it wasn't worth a damn. It bought nothing. There was nothing to buy. So I just left it in the office. Well, it accumulated. And they were able to buy one or two musical instruments. And then Simo and I were having a bit crack one day, and we thought, if we could get an amplifier, some speakers, the microphone, it would be much better for the central hall. That's where we had the musical interludes, for people to hear at the back of the hall. We had another object in mind as well. So, first of all, we asked the colonel if he had an old valve, any old scrap valve, just for to explain to the students what a valve looked like and how it worked and what have you.
This was the Italian colonel.
Italian colonel. So he sent for us. He says, you must not attempt to make a radio set. I said, well, it's bust. I said, well, that's it. Fair enough. So we asked him if we could have a amplifier, speakers, and a mic. The company office, our lads, they were agreeable. There was enough money, I think. So we got it. And we were called, Simo and I were called into the commandant's office. Colonel Papa. And he started to give us a dose of the, through the interpreter, of how's your father? If we made a set, a radio set, out of anything that was there, we would be shot. And there's no maybe about it. He said it was anointed with him. His orders were, hand them over to the Carabinieri, the Fascisti. And he says, once the Fascisti, the fascists, once they get you, he says, they will shoot you. There's nothing I can do. There's nothing anyone can do. It's the law now. You get the chop. Well, we didn't like to think they were pulling a fast one. So within 48 hours, we're listening at the BBC London. Because in the interpreter, he was dressed as an ordinary person, but once he was out the other side of the wire, they saluted him. He was an interpreter, but he was also an officer, just with the ordinary soldiers get up on it. He says, I wouldn't worry, fellas. He said, I wouldn't worry trying, because he says, we've got a guarantee from the firm that made this, that it was impossible to turn this into a radio set. Well, with Simo's brains on it, and my skill,
your hands,
we got cracking. And I said a couple of nights, as maybe it wasn't. A little while later, very short while later, we were in the company office and listening to BBC London.